Okay, today is March 16th, right, 1996, and this is Karen Brewster speaking with Max Brewer in his home in Anchorage. Closer to the microphone, so I won't worry about you so much. Okay, so I told you before a little what I'm doing, and I think if you don't mind, we start with some questions about you and how you got to Barrow and how you knew Harry, and then we'll just move on from there.
Okay. Actually, I went to Barrow in 50, but I became director of the laboratory in 56. And I was the seventh of the 10 directors to be succeeded by John Schindler, who was my assistant director for 11 and a half years. And John was succeeded by Warren Denner from the Navy Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, also who had been studying sea ice and oceanography. Warren was succeeded by John Kelly at the university. You probably know John.
I know his name.
So I went to Barrow on the 16th of September, 1950. I had left the previous Saturday from Grand Junction, Colorado, where it was 100 in the shade. The Saturday I arrived at Barrow, there was snow on the ground, and it was snowing. So that was a bit of a change. I went to Barrow to work on the thermal regime of permafrost. The reason that I had been sent to Barrow, and this was for the Geological Survey, was that I had live-trapped marten in British Columbia for two winters, and the people in the Geological Survey thought that I would be able to take care of myself in the climate at Barrow, which in 1950 was still not all that well known by many people down south. A friend who had the same background came up a couple months later to join me, a fellow by the name of Rudolph Black, who retired as an assistant secretary of the Department of Defense. He had spent 1 year at Barrow, and I stayed on. Originally, I was supposed to go to Barrow for 8 months. Time went on, and it was a little bit more than 4 years later when I'd planned to transfer to the office, Geological Survey office in San Francisco, and with the idea that I would come back to Barrow for a month, a couple times of the year. I had also met a nurse at the hospital, and we were married there and left Barrow the same day, the 2nd of October, 54. However, in November of 55, when there was some discussion of who would be the next director, I was asked if I would accept the position as director. effective the following fall. That I did. And the director was hired by the University of Alaska, which had the operating contract for the Barrow Laboratory. However, the hire was with the concurrence of the Navy. And the Navy had requested a geological survey to give me a 3-year leave of absence to accept the post. The geological survey agreed to a 1-year leave of absence, which eventually turned into being 21 years. And so that I went on to Barrow. At the time, the laboratory staff consisted of 8 people, including myself. 4 were native employees from Barrow. The other 4 administrative type employees from the South 48. Most of the previous directors had been from the biological fields, such as one from the the Museum of Natural History at Stanford, another assistant curator at the California Academy of Science, and the first full-time director was from Swarthmore, Larry Irving, who eventually ended up at the University of Alaska and for whom the Irving Building is mm-hmm. named. I was, there was also Ted Matthews, who had been a petroleum engineer and a graduate from the University of Alaska. However, I was the first year-round resident director, and with a background in the physical sciences, geology and geophysics. Some of the biological people were a little bit concerned that I might tend to favor the physical sciences, whereas in actuality it turned out that the during my tenure that the biological sciences had their greatest boom at Barrow. It was as director that I first really got to know Harry Brower. That's Harry K. Brower, a senior. In the spring of 1957, I wanted to hire 2 more native people from the village. And the I hired 1, Kenneth Tuock, to be the mechanical shop foreman and equipment operator. And then instead of 2, I added a 3rd one and hired Harry Brower and Joe Adjak for a term of 3 months. The 3 months beginning in the spring of 1957 lasted through my tenure, July 1971. Obviously, it took Harry and Joe a lot longer to complete their work than I had originally planned. Harry was, and Joe were both in the carpenter shop because, among other things, we were trying to do a certain amount of rehab of the laboratory and the surrounding buildings that we used, and also one to enhance the field capability away from Barrow, which meant more than having just a tent floor in a tent for a short stay by the investigators during the summer. As I say, obviously it took Harry and Joe a lot longer than they planned, or that I had thought originally. Harry was a quiet fellow with a sly sense of humor, and an ability to bond very well with the scientists. It turned out that in earlier years, when the investigators had been hiring some of Harry's children to catch lemmings, and the going price was tended to be 50 cents. When there came a flood, it dropped to a quarter, and in the scarce years up to a dollar, even $2. Harry's boys were tended to be entrepreneurs. And when a call would go out for a couple hundred lemmings, they would be in with a couple hundred lemmings. And then knowing that in a couple, 3 weeks, that there would be another request, sometimes they might have a few extras left over, which they would then put into the meat cellar and have available if there were to be a shortage in the catch at the next time. This kind of loused up the scientific part of the study, and I don't believe that the prime investigator in the Lemming Project ever caught on as to what was happening. In fact, it took me a while to catch on. And if you talk to some of Harry's boys, they could recall a few stories of that nature. It was during the early period that Harry worked at the laboratory that, as a going away present for one of the maintenance people, Harry took a lemming skin and made a lemming skin rug in the same way that you would make a polar bear skin rug, full head mount, except that Harry did not shorten the neck such as you have to do when you go ahead and mount a polar bear. And with the polar bear, that means that you cut out about 18 inches in the neck so that it looks like people think a bear should look, rather than like an elongated snake might look. And they take this polar bear skin that they take out, and when it was legal to take polar bears, and they would sell it to the people who made flies for fishing. The polar bear hairs are very stiff, and they are excellent in making flies. So this lemming skin rug was a big hit. A lot of people needed them. And so Harry was busy in the evenings making up these little lemming skin rugs. And he charged $5 a piece. Well, this was fine until he got this order from someplace in Mexico for 5,000 lemmingskin rugs. And he threw in the towel at that point. Harry, of course, as you know, wood carved ivory, and was very handy as that sort of thing. In fact, he was the last of the four Brower boys to have been taught taxidermy by his father. And in the early years, his father had quite a lucrative trade going with museums in the South 48, where he would furnish bird's nests, particularly eiderduck nests, with eggs and skins of one sort or another. So that Harry of the boys probably became the most expert in the taxidermy business. Harry made up the, you know, he was a carpenter, but I used him for many, many things. He, for instance, all the bird skins at the lab were prepared by Harry. Those eventually went to the university, and you could probably, if you went into the museum, find quite a number of them there. In the association, I got to know Harry fairly well, know of his wry humor, for instance. He was quite willing to tell a joke or a story on himself. And that's where I learned about when he was in the Alaska Scouts during World War II and was in Nome. Well, Harry was an 18-year-old at the time. He was flaked out in his bunk. And a major came into the barracks. Harry remained in the prone position. And the major started reading him the riot act up one side and down the other. And Harry was standing at attention and very near to tears because of the dressing down that he'd gotten. The major saw this and said, "Well, it's okay this time. After all, I am your brother." And that was James Brower of the second family, who had grown up in the South 48 after their mother had died during the measles epidemic. But there are a number of stories about Harry, and we got along quite well. We, two of us the same age, well, Harry 6 months younger than me. And so I learned a lot, particularly from Harry Pete Suvaluk, pronounced by the English people as Sobolik, who in my estimation was the greatest naturalist ever to be in northern Alaska. A man that had had 5 weeks of formal education, and a man who I sent out to field parties very often where I wanted to assist them and also protect people out in the bush. The third one that was extremely helpful in training me in the ways of the Arctic was Kenneth Tubuck, Sr., who had been my first native hire, and who remained at the laboratory after I had departed, and for several years thereafter. But Kenneth knew how to accomplish anything that had to be done. He was a fellow, and I have forgotten now whether he had had 5 or 7 grades of formal education. He had never taken mechanics in college. And by that I mean applied mechanics. But whereas in college, they don't teach you how to use leverage or to innovatively apply it in the field, Kenneth was and is the master in the application of mechanics. Essentially, they were my teachers. I was an earlier teacher, or a teacher, yes, earlier, back in 52, but in the name of Jacob Stalker. And he was from the Kotzebue area, actually upriver in Kotzebue, where he was and his family. It was at Barrow and was the first native ever allowed to live in one of the Navy oil teams. I took him to Cape Simpson as an assistant. And Jake was very familiar with English, very willing to talk and to explain things. The reason that the Navy in the exploration program from 44 to 53 did not have a native in the field camp was that the incidence of TB was extremely high in the village. At the time I went up, 70% of the people had or had had it. And so this was the approach that the Navy used. Jake, who I believe, well, as far as I know, is still living. About 5'5", maybe 155 or 160 pounds. But I used to have temperature cables that I would put down in the dry wells in the, to record temperatures. And some of the reels of cable were pretty heavy. I had one. They came with quite wide reels, weighing 600-700 pounds, and they would have two or four slats. And I know that one time I wanted to take the slats off one and to work on the cable head. So I had it in position, and I'd gotten some sawhorses, and so I wanted to lift it up and so that I could take it off and unreel some of the cable. And so I told Jake that, well, okay, I'd go over to the shop and get some help so we could get it up on the sawhorses. I came back with a couple of the fellows from the shop, and there the reel cable was sitting up on the sawhorses. And Jake was sitting on one end, smoking a cigarette. It was then that I learned that whenever you were dealing with the people who had been born and raised at Barrow, that the idea was to explain to them what you wanted to see as an end product, and then get out of their way as to how it was accomplished. That has served me well for the last 40 years. The years that I was at the laboratory encompassed the International Geophysical Year 1957-58, the IGY, and very continued, or a large increase in the number of people using the laboratory. And especially during the winter. Previous directors had arrived in the spring, stayed through the fall, and then essentially left their administrative assistant to run the laboratory during the winter. That meant that the laboratory, in a way, was a glorified summer camp for scientific support. And one of the things that the Navy had been most interested in was to develop the winter studies and also to expand out into the Arctic Ocean and the using ice stations as scientific platforms, floating ice stations. And for that, you needed someone year-round. The Navy also was aware that when the Navy closed out in 1953, that I, having the largest project up there, had pointed out that, well, our work wasn't done and that we would stay. And so the laboratory stayed open that first winter after the Navy closed out, although on a limited scale. And with the construction of the Dew Line being pretty well complete by the end of 1957, the Navy also was anxious that perhaps I could use some of the procedures that I had used earlier in helping to make the phase out of that program somewhat more smooth, and to also be able to continue operating the laboratory. In that regard, it should be noted that prior to 1 October 1953, there had been a contractor that operated the camp, and that after the Navy departed on 1 October 53, the laboratory was the only one in the camp, and it operated selected units in the camp until the construction of the Dew Line began in January of 1955, when again a massive construction project and with contractors had moved into the camp. Well, as they were leaving, well, here the laboratory again would have perhaps have much of the responsibility. So my previous experience was of interest to the Navy. Should we take a break?
Sure.
But so the with the Navy's desire to get offshore, and the also a desire to increase the scope of the laboratory operations, it was my feeling that if people could use light airplanes to go out and hunt polar bears using the buddy system, that you could also use light airplanes to go out and land on the ice and make temporary oceanographic stations. And we started out with a project desiring to make oceanographic stations, contracting for two light aircraft in the spring of 1957. The aircraft were Ronkas, and the pilots that we had in the operation were Frank Gregory, who had been a mechanic and for the contractor in the early days, and had married a girl from the village, and Robert J. Fisher, Bobby, Senior. In June of that year, the Navy had provided funds to buy two aircraft for the laboratory. And so the thought was that we should go ahead and get one pilot was a beginning. And I had been out flying, putting out a project on the Awoona River, and I happened to be flying with Bobby. Frank, an excellent pilot, took off across the river, and Bobby, flying taxied down a bar in the river, and we took off from the bar. And it was during that flight that I determined that I would prefer Bobby as the laboratory's pilot, because here was a fellow who was very steady, excellent pilot, and would not push either the airplane or himself any more than was required to get the job done, so that I felt that he would be the safer type pilot. And so Bobby became the laboratory's first pilot and chief pilot after we hired others. We used the aircraft to support our field stations on land during the summer, and then during the spring period, particularly this time of year, I used them for the ice studies. In fact, we expanded from motion graphic to running gravity stations, and we gridded the north bearing even over around Wrangell Island, and essentially about 400 miles to sea. Also during the IGY, the Air Force and the Navy were interested in establishing ice stations offshore. One of them they established was Station Alpha, an Air Force station, and the Catholic priest at Barrow, Father Tom Cunningham, was the ice advisor for the Air Force. The Air Force had also set up a station on Ice Island T3, or Fletcher's Ice Island, named for Joe Fletcher, a colonel in the Air Force, who had been the one to first discover T3. And the reason it was called T3 is that it was not visually sighted, but sighted by radar, and it was called Target 3. And it was, of course, the third such ice station that had been followed. It's my estimation, or belief, that a big chunk of fresh ice that had been spotted off Barrow in 1950 was a piece of T3. It was first observed by George and Nettie McGinnity. George McGinnity had succeeded Larry Irving as director of the laboratory. George was a marine geologist, his wife, marine biologist. George passed away here, I think, about 3 years ago at age 100.
Wow.
And, however, he had been medical evacuation from Barrow in August of 1950 because of a heart attack. And so he was succeeded as director by the director of the Museum of Natural History at Stanford, Ira Wiggins, who passed away a few years ago at age 90. And he had been succeeded by G. Dallas Hanna, assistant curator at the Cal Academy of Science, a marine geologist and paleontologist who had first worked in the Pribilof Islands in 1911. He passed away some years ago, age 84, and I think that was Larry Irving's age when he passed away. They had all worked under the contract when the Navy contract when it was operated by Johns Hopkins University. The first director under the University of Alaska contract was Ted Matthews. He had been a graduate there and a petroleum engineer for the Navy at Beryl. And Ira Wiggins pulled to Grover Cleveland and came back for the summer months in 1956 and succeeded him. Getting back to the ice station, I flew in the ice observing for the Navy Air Force joint project to set up an ice station, Charlie, which was a successor to the first ice station, Alpha. And with the station Charlie, there must have been a Bravo, and that was the name that was given to T3 for a while. I flew 140 hours in 10 days in searching for a likely ice flow. Platform out in the Arctic Ocean, getting up to a bit beyond 81 north in the search. Finally chose the station at 76 north for Charlie, and I still have the original flag that on that station. Ice Station Charlie was different in the mode of establishment than either of the other two, where you had the heavier aircraft go in and then make the first landing. In that, on Ice Station Charlie, we used the lab two Cessnas to fly out, make the first landing, and check the area, and a DC-3 on skis, the Navy designation R-4D, the Air Force C-47, and then to call in the DC-3. Much of the rest of the material to get the station going was then paradropped from the C-54s. And so that gave us the sort of an in. Well, Station Charlie, established in the spring of 1959, developed some cracks across the runway in early January of 1960, and it was of great concern to the Air Force, which was operating the station, even though it was funded by the Navy. And so they determined that it should be evacuated. The Navy scientific officer named Max Britton, who had worked at Beryl in 1952, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I both flew north to try to talk the Air Force into keeping the station. But it had been the airstrip had been reduced to 3,600 feet in length, and since they were committed to heavy aircraft, they needed 5,000 foot runway. This left the Navy into a position that if they wanted to continue studies out in the Arctic Basin, that perhaps they'd better operate the stations themselves, and so the laboratory was tasked to do that. At the same time, we didn't have any larger aircraft available to either establish or to support a station. We decided to put one out using an icebreaker in 1960. And we built the Wanigans, actually sections, so that they could be put up readily, and loaded them on the icebreaker Burton Island for the trip. The Navy provided a P-2V for one ice reconnaissance flight over the ice, which I had made going out to 75 north and then turning due east. As we got over to about 140, essentially north of the Alaska-Canadian border, I had noticed that there had been a tendency for a little weakening in the ice. And this was important because it had been a rough ice year. The ice was very near the shore, and it was very heavy. So I came back and I told the icebreaker skipper that, well, if we headed for the long coast over to the area north of Mackenzie and then went up along the west coast of Banks Island, that I thought that we could find a weakness to penetrate into the ice. This we did, and at 75 north we managed to get 210 miles into the ice with the icebreaker. I know that near the time that we were getting fairly deep into the ice, the Navy had an overflight, and they sent a message to the skipper asking what were his intentions in view of the ice conditions that surrounded. In Navy language, that could be translated into, "What in hell are you doing there?" And so he asked me about it, and I said, out to establish ARLIS 1, which stood for Arctic Research Laboratory Ice Station number 1. We proceeded to set up the, found a reasonable flow, and set up the station. It took us about 48 hours to set it up. And then when the ship tried to leave, it took us another 24 hours to get the first half mile as we departed. The laboratory still had its two Cessna 180s, but no DC-3 for support, so That winter, as the ice station drifted to the west, we supported it using the Cessnas. And when the equipment operator and mechanic of the station was Frankie Ocpic. And but essentially the station was, we had one weasel as far as running equipment, and there was just a lot of manpower utilized. However, we could never say that we had to abandon the station because our airstrip was in danger, because when we established it, we had no airstrip. And this was the one of the advantages that we had. We operated that ice strip until mid-March, and when we were thought that, well, we could find a better flow, again, go to the northeast, because when we abandoned the station, it was to the northwest of Barrow. And so this was fine, plane to go out, and it was about that time that the shop with all of our prefab buildings burned. So here the question was whether or not we could go ahead and put the station out that year. And yes, and although it would be tough, the Wanigans that we used for the first two stations were 12 by 16 feet. And they had the plywood. The interior walls were plywood. And we had the insulation. And then on the outside, we used 6 mil Visqueen, heavy plastic. And the idea was that, well, in the interior then, you had some place that you could hang things, one thing or another. And then any moisture that went through would be on form as ice on the Visqueen. And you just run around the hut, you know, pat the Visqueen, all the ice would fall down, and so maintain your insulation. And also be very light in weight. The structure itself weighed a little less than 1,800 pounds. And so this was fine. We set up. There was a thought that we would not be able to establish a station that year because it was too late in the season. However, we set out on the 12th of May.
What year was that?
1961. The 12th of May to put out the station. I was flying in one of the Cessnas with Bobby Fisher. By that time, we had the lab had a DC-3 or R-4D on skis. And the idea, two light planes, pilot and passenger in each one, and in the DC-3, then pilot, co-pilot, radio operator, and a one the carpenter, and carpenter in the other. We had a total of 8 men, 3 airplanes. And the plan there was that, okay, if we ran into trouble, that, and lost a plane, that all the people could come back in the, whichever two remained. The idea was that when we chose a station, the lead plane, lead Cessna 180, would go in and land, see if it was proper, wave the second 180 in, then wave the DC-3 in. We're flying along, and we are not all that far north, and the Air Force then was still operating T-3, which had come in somewhat closer to shore. And so I'm reading the newspaper, looking out on the ice. Finally I said, "Bobby, are you off course?" Kind of shook him because Bobby could read the ice like the back of his hand. "No." He checked. Well, I said, "I think that's T-3 over there." I said, "That looks like an ice island, you know, in the distance." I said, "Let's swing over." We swung over here and that way. And Bobby was right. He was on course. And I was right. It was an ice island. That's a piece of glacier ice. Large in diameter, for instance, T3. When originally occupied, was 4 by 9 miles. And this ice island was 2 by 4 miles with a crack in the center. So in effect, it was two sections. It eventually became two sections, 2 by 2 miles. And so we flew around the area where the crack was, sort of a little embayment, new ice, nice and smooth. So, asked Bobby to go ahead and land. Tromped over the area a bit, pulled the other Cessna in, and then the R-4D. We drilled to make sure that the ice was thick enough for the R-4D. Bobby could always tell the thickness of the ice just by looking at it. You know, if it was whether it was a few inches or a couple feet. But when you start getting into deeper ice, then from eyeballing it, it's more difficult. And so it's nice to be on the safe side. And so I said, "Well, this is Arliss 2. And we were north of 73 then. So the area that found for a landing in the with the R-4D was reasonably smooth, and so no trouble landing, and offloaded, and the supplies and the first building. And the idea was that with the people on the ice, and the two planes stayed overnight on the ice, and the idea was that by late evening that they would have the first Wanigan up, and that so that, you know, in effect, you had shelter. And the two light airplanes stayed until the shelter was up and radio contact established with Barrow and the Homer beacon operating. And then they would come back, which was usually the following morning. And then it was get the supplies in fast. Well, this was fine with the, we were doing great with the R4D, but skis on an R4D weigh 1,300 pounds. And that reduces your payload by a like amount. So since the strip was pretty good, decided we'd take the skis off. That would mean we could get stuff in faster. This was working out fine. We had probably 2/3 of the supplies for the summer on the station. And it had rained, and this had softened the snow. And there was a ridge running across the area that they were landing. And even though it had been hard packed with this rain, it softened. And this little ice ridge there, as planes coming in, caused it to swerve. And it went over to the side, and we found out later there was a ditch there with a deep snow, and the plane had gone up, curled the props, and then as the back end came down, had broken off the tail wheel. So on that plane, we had explosives for use during the summer in one of the projects. And I think we had about 500 pounds of explosives, but no problem. And in retrospect, it just kind of makes the hair curl in the back of your neck a bit. But so the pilots came in and reported that, you know, actually, I went out with two Cessnas to survey the damage. So what the problem was, and so the pilots, well, how are we going to get the plane back? And my comment was, don't even concern it until we get the station set up, because by then it's late May and getting a little touchy for the conditions for landings. So we had, by that time, we had two Cessna 195s. And so I had three pilots. So here, with the two Cessna 180s and the 195, we started flying in the rest of the supplies for the summer, which we got in. And